What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part three of our talk about the plague, the second plague pandemic, the Black Death, and specifically some religious responses to it. Now, in parts one and two, in part one, we sort of focused on the plague itself, some questions about how it was transmitted, what the different pandemics looked like, and so forth. And then in the second episode, we focused largely on religious responses to the plague in Christian Europe. Today, we wanted to expand talking about religious responses to the plague and talk about some historical work on Islamic responses. But to begin this discussion, I wanted to start by reading a wonderful tale that I came across in a paper by a scholar that I'm going to be referring to later in this episode. So this story was originally told by an Ottoman historian in the late 15th century about events that allegedly happened, I think, in northwest Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey. And the translation and retelling of the story is by a modern historian named Nuket Varlik, who I believe is currently a professor in the history department at the University of South Carolina. But Rob, if you're ready, I'm going to read this tale.
Let's do it.
On the first night of January of 1494, while transporting a load from Gallipoli to Edirne with other fellow laborers, a wagon driver had an accident in Bolayir. When his ox was injured on the road and could not move any further, his fellow drivers went to town to bring help, leaving him alone to spend the night on the accident site. Later that evening, when the unfortunate wagon driver was crying in despair, he suddenly heard a loud noise, whereupon he saw two horsemen in black attire astride black horses racing toward him. In fear, he hid under the wagon and watched them going by like a lightning. Immediately after them, a horseman in green attire, riding a pale horse and waving a lightning whip, came by and called out to him, "Oh, you driver! Have you seen two horsemen in black attire riding black horses?" When the driver showed him in which direction they went, the horseman then asked the driver what he was waiting for. Once the driver told him about the accident, the horseman descended from his horse and touched the leg of the ox three times, and the beast was miraculously healed. Upon seeing this, the driver moved toward the horseman in gratitude and inquired about his whereabouts. The horseman revealed himself as Prophet Hizir, helping those in need. He added that he was chasing the horsemen, quote, "They are pestilence and plague. They live among people. God sent them. They obey the orders of God. I have received an order from God to expel them. They were 8 in total. I killed 6 of them. If I can kill those 2 before they reach the seashore, there shall not be another plague for 30 years.
Oh, wow. I kind of want to see the rest of the movie. I mean, this is delightfully cinematic.
Yeah, the riders in black, the ringwraiths, and then a hero in green with a lightning whip upon a pale horse chasing down plague to kill it.
Yeah.
So this tale was originally set down by a 15th century Ottoman chronicler named Oruç, and I found the retelling in a paper called From Bête Noire to Le Mal de Constantinople, Plagues, Medicine, and the Early Modern Ottoman State, by an author named Nuket Varlık in the Journal of World History in 2013. And this is a paper that documents evidence of how the conceptualization of plague and the administrative reaction to it within the Ottoman Empire changed over the course of several centuries. But regarding that tale itself, one fact I found funny was that despite the supernatural details that make it seem like an obvious piece of creative storytelling, the original chronicler, Oruç, apparently claims that it is based on the testimony of several trustworthy witnesses. So I'm not sure what to make of that. But anyway, Varlık highlights it in her paper as a fascinating example of popular plague narrative and one that reveals some common features of thought about epidemic disease in the Ottoman Empire. So apparently this story bears strong resemblance to other tales like it going back to the early Islamic period, in which there's usually like a man in green riding a pale horse who appears in times of epidemic disease or other struggle and helps people rid themselves of pestilence or rid themselves of jinn, which are a form of supernatural creature, a kind of demon that might be made of air or flame. And there are other common elements too, such as the figure in green touching a wound or touching an animal or say a leg 3 times in order to heal it. And so the hero in this story, given the name Hizir here, is also known, I've seen spelled as Al-Qadir or Al-Qadir, so that's sometimes like A-L-K-H-A-D-I-R, which means the green one, I believe, though I think there's some etymological debate about where that name comes from. It's largely taken, I think, to mean the green one or the verdant one. He's a sort of saint or guardian angel type figure who appears in Islamic lore going very far back. So Varlık says this story would have had very familiar narrative elements to listeners and readers in 15th century Anatolia, but there are also unusual elements. For example, the portrayal of plague and pestilence as riders in black is, she says, otherwise rare or perhaps even unique to this story at this point in Ottoman literature. Though it's interesting to me because at least now that's a motif that seems utterly natural, like depicting plague as embodied as a rider wearing a black cloak on a black horse. Like that seems like something I would have encountered in stories all the time. So I'm wondering if it comes from this or if there are parallel traditions in other cultures.
Yeah, because certainly from a Western perspective and with the benefit of you know, multiple centuries to look back on, that's the Grim Reaper, the black hooded figure like this is just such a staple of Western traditions and Western depictions of evil and these forces of destruction. Yeah, but did it exist within Islamic thought or within Ottoman thought at the time, beyond this one story, that is?
Yeah. And so Varlık says this story is actually a pretty excellent reflection of how Ottoman Muslims of the time period generally thought about plague as part of what she calls the Islamic plague cosmology of the 15th century, which she characterizes as a system of explanations that are ultimately revolving around divine causation, around God. So she writes, quote, "According to this, plagues were inflicted upon humans by God, and God alone had the power to relieve humans from this ill. In its broadest outlines, this vision of divine origins and agency prevailed in the Islamic world throughout the ages, and as such remained the predominant discourse circulating both orally and in written texts. And so in this way, it sounds at least in part comparable to what we discussed in the previous episode regarding Christian Europe, which was that there may have been many different beliefs at the time in Christian Europe about the proximate causes of plague. You know, was it miasma, a type of bad air that's pervading the towns, or was it astrological causes? You know, was it a conjunction of the planets coming into a terrible catastrophic alignment, or earthquakes releasing vapors from the ground or something? But whatever the proximate causes were, most authors in Christian Europe at the time would generally trace the causal chain at some point back to divine will. God sent this plague. But regarding the Islamic views on the causes of plague, I do want to be clear that Varlick qualifies this characterization by stressing that there is not just one monolithic Islamic tradition, nor was there only one type of view held by Muslims at the time. And in fact, the rest of her paper, after this opening story, is devoted to showing how the multiple discourses in Ottoman society, beginning mostly under this umbrella of Islamic plague cosmology, where basically all of the causes of plague are divine, how that evolved over the years, and then especially during the 16th century, transformed into a radically different and more medical or naturalistic theory of the causes of plague and what the appropriate responses to it should be.
Yeah, I think it's also worth remembering that the Islamic world during the centuries we're talking about here, they had access to a great deal of important knowledge. In some cases, knowledge that had essentially been lost to Western Europe, and sometimes only accessed again in Europe through Islamic texts. So, in Western-centric imaginings of things, it might be easy to dream up this world of monks, libraries, knights, and peasants on one hand, and then this monolithic religion on the other. But the Islamic world harbored some of the greatest minds of the age.
Well, yeah, a lot of European wisdom of the time was actually derived from works produced by the Islamic world in the Middle Ages. Say, from a big example that we referenced in a previous episode is the Persian polymath Avicenna, who is sometimes considered one of the fathers of modern medicine, and that his work was very influential not just in the Islamic world but also in Christian Europe. Now, I want to come back and revisit Varlick's paper a little bit later in the episode, but for a bit, I'd like to shift to talk about some of the major themes in the existing comparative analysis of how Christians and Muslims responded to the Black Death and its recurrent waves, because I know this was one of the things that got you interested in this subject to begin with, but then it was one of those subjects where as soon as you start to get a peek in through the window, you realize that it's like very complex. There's and like every time you read something and you think you know a fact, then there's like you read something else and realize, oh no, maybe that's not as clear as it once seemed. And this seems to be a common feature, not just of comparing Christian and Islamic reactions to, say, plague in the Middle Ages, but a common feature of the history of comparative religious analysis. I like comparative religious analysis. It's really interesting. You can learn a lot from comparing and contrasting different religious traditions, but it's also very, very tricky. It's one of those subject areas where you can easily be tempted into forming inaccurate generalizations on the basis of a small set of evidence, and you've got a kind of natural zeal to identify patterns and trends. You want to be able to make general statements and make characterizations so it looks like you have actually discovered facts that generally hold true. But sometimes the zeal to make fact statements of that kind overcomes what should be some caution and what should be caution and humility in the face of trying to characterize something as complex as a religious response. I actually remember this came up when we were reading papers about iconic versus aniconic religious traditions. You know, it seems like scholars who engage in comparative religious analysis today are increasingly conscious of the need to be kind of frugal and tentative with generalizations about the similarities and differences between entire religions and the communities that practice them. Because comparing and contrasting two religions isn't like comparing and contrasting the features of geometrical shapes. You know, like you can list the all of the differences and similarities between a right triangle and an isosceles triangle or something. But you know, religions are extremely complex social phenomena. And sometimes you're not even aware of what you're missing out on as a function of the sources of evidence available to you.
Yeah, like I think we've discussed this in terms of, say, Buddhism, for example. You know, I mean, if you talk very generally about Buddhism, well, are you accounting for the different regional versions of the faith? Are you dealing with the different social levels within a given community? Like, there's so many different divisions that can be that you can pull on, and if you're just being very general about it, yeah, it might help you prop up a point you're trying to make, but you're certainly not going to be doing a fair job of speaking to how that particular model of faith impacts the human condition at large.
I mean, I think about how difficult it is to make accurate generalizations about something as complex as, say, a religion, even when you live amongst it. Like, how would you make accurate characterizations about, say, Catholicism in 21st century America, even though, like, you probably know a bunch of Catholics in America in the 21st century, and, like, you know, you're immersed in a culture in which this is one part of it. So it seems like you should have a really good view about it, but then it's still probably hard to make accurate generalizations. And now imagine you had to make those generalizations hundreds of years later, working off of a select number of surviving books from the period, and that's pretty much it. So anyway, all that to say that when you engage in this type of stuff, it's important to have a spirit of humility and be cautious about how much you think you know. And following from that, something we talked about in the previous episodes is that, much like the scientific history of the plague pandemic itself, the subject of the Islamic response, religious response to plague, has undergone some revision and reexamination in recent decades. And so here I think maybe it makes sense to introduce two different papers that I've been looking at to introduce what seems to me to be one, an example of sort of the dominant historical characterizations from, say, the late 20th century, alongside a more recent paper I found talking about some reexamination of those claims. So to start with the older characterizations, I'll refer to a paper I quoted in the previous episode. It's a piece called "The Comparative Communal Responses to the Black Death in Muslim and Christian Societies" by Michael W. Doles, published in the 1970s. This is the historian Michael W. Doles, who lived 1942 to 1989. And this piece was actually the place I found that description of the plague from the 14th century North African Muslim historian Ibn Khaldun, which was, you remember that really haunting description of like the cities being emptied and the way signs falling away. And what did he say? It was as if the voice of existence in the world had called out for oblivion and restriction, and the world had responded to its call.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's the Doles piece I'm going to be looking at, but then also providing some more recent or revised understanding, though not just responding to Doles. I was also reading an article by Justin Stearns, who I believe is a professor at NYU Abu Dhabi, who specializes in Muslim history. And this one is called "New Directions in the Study of Religious Responses to the Black Death." And I should stress that though Stearns disagrees with a few of Doles' generalizations that he makes, he says that overall Doles' history is like a really important and excellent work.
It is. It does seem to be widely cited.
So it's not like the older one is like bad. It's just like he maybe could have had more nuance in it.
Gotcha.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I think in the previous episode, we talked about how even if you put religious ideas aside for a moment, that Christian and Muslim societies in to some degree tended to share the same dominant mechanical theories of the spread of plague, where they had mechanical theories of the spread, which was the most common was that they were rooted in miasma theory. Again, this is the idea that there would be some form of bad air spreading the plague, and that this would have been derived from the common heritage of medical authorities like Hippocrates, Galen, and Avicenna. But then Dole says that European Christian and Muslim reactions were quite dissimilar in terms of their religious responses, and that this tells us something about the essential identity of each religious culture. So Dole has 3 major claims about the dominant views of Muslim religious authorities during the Black Death, and they go like this, and we can come back and analyze or maybe question these as we move along. So first of all, Dole says that plague was viewed as a mercy from God and a martyrdom for the faithful Muslim. And so this is an interesting variation to the extent that it's true, because by being a martyrdom, this would make dying from plague a form of honorable death that will ensure that the martyr is delivered to paradise. And this stands in contrast to the widespread Christian view that plague was a divine punishment for sin, though Dole's mentions some Muslim opinion that plague could be a punishment for sin in some cases, or say for non-believers. All right, so the second tenet is, quote, a Muslim should not enter nor flee from a plague-stricken land. And apparently this is a long-standing prophetic tradition in Islam, and to the extent that people did hold this belief, it would obviously interfere with them protecting themselves by fleeing plague-ridden towns. And then the third point is that, quote, there was no contagion of plague since disease came directly from God. And this is allegedly in contrast to Christian Europe, where although there was no germ theory of disease, you could see that there was some kind of rudimentary concept of contagion, the idea that somehow by being around plague, you could get plague, though the mechanisms might have been obscure. So I think the difference here is that Doles is claiming that while in Europe there was broadly an idea that plague could be transmitted by some kind of brute physical causation, you could somehow just like get plague from the environment. In the Muslim world, plague was given to you directly by supernatural means, by God, and thus didn't physically spread. And Doles emphasizes these claims he makes by putting them in contrast to what he would claim about Christian Europe. So he writes, quote, "The importance of these three principles to Muslim society was in what they did not affirm. They did not declare that plague was God's punishment. They did not encourage flight, and they did not support a belief in the contagious nature of plague, all of which were prevalent in Christian Europe." However, he does qualify these. He also does not treat these as the universal blanket statements. He says that while these three religio-legal tenets, or what he calls them, while they were generally held, it would be untrue and unreasonable to believe they were held universally, and there was some measure of scholarly debate about them. So as for the first principle, the idea that plague is a mercy and a martyrdom from God, there is some historical and literary evidence of people believing the opposite in Muslim societies, that in some cases it was viewed as a punishment for sin, like it was commonly in Christian Europe, rather than as a mercy. So just one example I came across, I was reading that paper by Nukhet Varlik, and she mentions a saying of a 15th century Ottoman scholar who attributes plague to adultery. He says, you know, when adultery takes place, you know, that can only foster evil upon the world, and that evil becomes plague, which sounds kind of like some of the things that we were talking about in the last episode that were commonly believed in Europe.
Yeah.
Now, there might be some doubt about these three characterizations he makes, but first I did just want to mention some consequences that Doles believes follows from these three facts he believes to be true about the Muslim response to plague. One major difference is that Muslim societies do not really seem to record what he calls, quoting another source, the, quote, "striking manifestations of abnormal collective psychology, of dissociation of the group mind that were present in Christian Europe." So, for example, he says that there's really no evidence that Muslim societies produced apocalyptic messianic movements in response to the Black Death, as did Christian Europe. So think of the flagellants that we talked about last time. And he thinks that this may be in part due to a relative lack of theological precedent in Islamic tradition. Quote, "Furthermore, the fact that there was no certainty that plague was a divine punishment for sin removed the impetus for a cohesive puritanical and revivalist popular movement."
Yeah, because if you think back to what we discussed in the last episode, there was this sense that the system is failing. Like, why are we still being punished by God for our sins? What more do we have to do? Perhaps we have to work outside the system, and it leads to these various heretical threads, such as the flagellants, you know, becomes a movement. And you can see where if there's not a precedent for those kinds of movements, and you don't have as much of this emphasis of plague being directly caused by personal or communal sin, then there's less room for that to grow.
Right. Now, there's another important difference that the Doles argues. He says that minority communities in Muslim lands were not persecuted as a reaction to the plague, certainly not to the extent that they were in Europe. For example, the way that Jews were persecuted in communities throughout Christian Europe as a sort of a violent outburst in response to the plague. And Doles thinks this may be in part derivative of his claim that Muslims did not generally believe in contagion, but rather believed that plague was sent directly from God. So the way that would work is, if you can't really get the plague from a physical cause, like if you know, it's just God deciding whether or not you get plague, if you can only get it straight from the divine realm, then you couldn't really have these delusional conspiracy theories about Jews poisoning the wells and so forth.
Now, speaking of the Jewish persecution during the Black Death, I want to throw in just one little bit here. I had some notes on this, but then we ended up not covering it. And then we heard from a listener on the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module, which is the Facebook group for discussion of the show. I heard from Adam, who is a rabbi, and was writing in about between these episodes about a book that they'd read titled The Jew in the Medieval World by Jacob R. Marcus. So basically this added wrinkle in the Jewish persecution during the Black Death was that there was apparently this charge that Jewish people were less affected by plague and that this was this indicated that they were somehow involved in it. Now, to be clear, as we stressed in the last episode, Jewish people did die of plague like everyone else and at an appalling rate. But there, it is sometimes asked whether Jewish hygiene practices might have given them a slight edge over the rest of the population in terms of previous illnesses and outbreaks and even with the Black Death. So it's interesting to think about. It's worth stressing that this form of anti-Semitic messaging continued on for centuries, and you see variations of this even during the 20th century. I've seen images of a Polish poster, for example, that invokes fears of typhus, connecting Jewish people to typhus. Which is just another example of anti-Semitic persecution. But to your point, if there is a widespread belief that that afflictions like this come directly from God and cannot be acquired from other communities or other individuals within your own community, then there's less room to engage in this kind of thought.
Right, because you couldn't think that it was like somehow a physical weapon being used against you by, say, a persecuted minority group that you had suspicions and resentments toward.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, all this ties into something that the Dole says ultimately, where he characterizes the Muslim reaction to plague as relatively, quote, pacific, collective, and controlled compared to the response to plague in Christian Europe. There's a long quote. I guess I'm not going to read this whole, but I'm going to read part of it where he's sort of summing up what he sees as some of the major differences and how they grow from the different theological emphases of these two religions. He says, quote, "The cosmic settings of the two faiths are wide apart in their emphasis, where the Muslims' primary duty was toward the correct behavior of the total community based on the sacred law, the Christians was with personal redemption. Where the Quran supplied guidance, the Bible furnished consolation. For the Muslim, the Black Death was part of a God-oriented natural universe. For the Christian, it was an eruption of the profane world of sin and misery."
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I've been mentioning that with these three generalizations that Doles makes, I wanted to come back and possibly interrogate them or question them to some extent by consulting this paper I was reading by Justin Stearns from 2009. And this paper makes clear Stearns is very much a fan of evaluating the religious responses of Christians, Muslims, and Jews to the plague. So it's not like he thinks it is not a worthwhile project to engage in comparative historical religious analysis. That's what he's clearly into. He does talk about how previous scholarship has regarded the responses of the three religions here as fundamentally different in important ways, such as how they conceptualize contagion, like we were just talking about. And one of the things that Stearns emphasizes is that these distinctions are not necessarily so clear as they have seemed to other scholars, and that there is often more internal diversity and debate within each religion than has previously been appreciated, and more similarities between their responses than is sometimes appreciated. I'm not going to go in depth on every point he makes in this paper, but there was one thing he gets into early on that's slightly orthogonal to what we're talking about, but I did think was very interesting, which was about the idea of local versus universal. And it's sort of the idea that you can't really understand the second plague pandemic if you only think about the initial outbreak in the middle of the 14th century in Europe. You need to think more broadly in terms of time and geography. But at the same time, you can't just think about the plague, the second plague pandemic, which in a way you could argue goes on for centuries, as something that had global effects continuously for the entire time that it was present, because each outbreak of plague in each individual region, each new epidemic, could be perceived by the people experiencing it as at least potentially local and unique. It was happening to them in the place where they lived, and it was this current disaster. Mm. You know, we can sometimes be lured by the breadth of history into thinking that people in other times and places in history understood they were living in a historical trend much more than they did. You know, like we don't even really understand the historical trends that we're living in until we're right at the end of them often.
Yeah. And sometimes not even then, like it's, you know, it's difficult to look back on previous decades and think of them as like historical periods in the same way we might view some, you know, like say the 80s, the 70s, the 60s. But, you know, like the last 20 years have kind of feel like just sort of a recent blur to me. Like it's hard to think of those as important, like pillars of time.
Yeah. It's, you know, the present always feels kind of unique. And, mm-hmm. and it is only in looking back that you're really able with confidence to identify all the ways in which the present for you, now the past, is like the even further past.
Yeah. And I guess also we have with modern media, of course, we have a more global perspective, or we have access to a more global perspective at times regarding what's happening in the world. And there's also maybe a tendency to want to package everything. You know, you need a title for this segment. So, I guess you could make a case for some of that going on in prior ages with different, writers and commentators. But yeah, it wasn't a situation where you would turn on your global news channel and see, you know, what we're calling this present darkness.
Right.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, here I want to come to Stearns's interrogation of some of these generalizations made by Michael Doles. So I think the first one we should look at is this question of, did Muslims at the time of the Black Death generally accept a theory of contagion or not? I remember this was Doles's third generalization. He says that there really was no contagion of plague in Muslim consciousness, since disease came directly from God. It was caused supernaturally, not by any kind of physical mechanism that would allow it to spread from person to person or in an area. And Stearns argues that there's actually a lot at stake in our understanding of these kinds of attitudes toward plague. And especially you can see how characterizations of this kind get applied to situations that they might not really be good analogies for. For example, he cites the example of many Europeans hundreds of years ago, not like modern historians, but people in the 16th and 17th centuries, Protestant authors, using what they believe to be the historical example of Turkish Muslims' reaction to the plague within arguments about whether Christians had a moral duty to stay in plague-ridden areas in order to help their Christian neighbors, or whether they should flee the disease in order to protect themselves. And authors who advocated fleeing the disease sometimes compared their opponents to Turkish Muslims because they believed that Turkish Muslims had a fatalistic attitude toward plague and would not try to escape it. You can find numerous references in the 16th and 17th century of European authors talking about it like this, like, for example, Leibniz, apparently in mounting an argument against fatalism, used Turkish Muslims during plague outbreaks as an example of the philosophy of fatalism. They failed to escape areas affected by plague, even when they easily could have. And he regards this, I guess, as foolish. And here in this question about the belief in contagion in the Muslim world, we actually get to a specific historical figure, a figure known as Ibn al-Hatib. And Stearns describes al-Hatib as the prolific and rightly celebrated Granadan vizier and man of letters. This was a scholar who lived in southern Iberia under the Emirate of Granada during the 14th century. And in the years after the Black Death, al-Hatib wrote a famous treatise called On the Plague, in which he argued that the plague was in fact contagious, despite some theological judgments to the contrary, and offered citations of empirical evidence to prove it. Michael Doles in that piece does acknowledge al-Hatib, and on the issue of contagion cites him as one very important exception. So Doles writes, quote, as for the third problem of contagion, the Andalusian scholar Ibn al-Hatib has attracted European attention for his observation and forceful statement of the contagious nature of the Black Death. This points, however, to the exceptional nature of Ibn al-Hatib's belief and the weight of opinion against him. Ibn al-Hatib was the only Muslim writer, to my knowledge, to argue against the accepted interpretation of plague. His forthright statement is probably one of the portions of his writings which gave support to his enemies in their later persecution of him as a heretic. Mm. And so in the latter thing here, this refers to the fact that at the end of his life, Al-Hatib was caught up in a series of palace coups and political power struggles, after which in one of them, he was jailed after being convicted by a sort of panel of jurists. And at some point, he was murdered in his jail cell after being tried for heresy. Though Stearns argues that this was not necessarily as a result of his comments about the plague and may have just as well been a... just kind of a pure power play, like he was murdered by his political opponents. And Stearns writes that this series of events, quote, has been widely construed by students of medieval European history as having been due to the rigid and intolerant nature of Islamic orthodoxy, and I suspect a general impression that scientific thought in the Muslim world was in decline. So Stearns argues that both of these ideas, that Muslims in general rejected belief in contagion, and that Ibn al-Hatib was a, quote, free-thinking exception in a sea of fatalistic, narrow-minded Muslim jurists and theologians, that both of these ideas have been around for a long time and are continuously represented in scholarship on the Black Death of the period, but Stearns kind of pushes back against them. Now, he does seem to agree that theological rejection of the theory of contagion was, in fact, the most common view in the pre-modern Arab Muslim world. But he says that Ibn al-Hatib's support for contagion theory, rather than being the single lone voice of dissent, was actually probably more like a particularly rhetorically powerful phrasing of a view that was a minority opinion, but was nevertheless pretty widely held and openly discussed by plenty of Muslim jurists.
And this makes sense, right? Because outside of the various like philosophical and theological ideas that either population, European or Islamic world, would have had, there would have been like direct observation. There would have been there would have been room to realize there's something to the way this illness spreads. There's something about physical proximity to other people with the illness that you could potentially pick up on.
Though complicated by the fact that, as we discussed in the first episode, the transmission vectors of the historical plague outbreaks are still somewhat obscure to us today. Like, there's still debate about to what extent plague was spread by contagion from other people. Remember, in the first episode we talked about, so there's this idea for a long time that plague is primarily spread in bubonic form from bites, from fleas, from commensal rodents or other animals, and that probably represents some amount of spread. But then there are other ways it can spread. So you can get the pneumonic version of the plague, and then it can be spread in aerosolized droplets. You know, people cough and spread it person to person that way. And then there is this more recent idea that maybe it was spread person to person, but through the vector of human ectoparasites, fleas and lice on people's bodies. But all this to say, because there is not one single way the plague is spreading, but probably multiple different routes, and we're still not sure what percentage of transmission these different routes represented, it obviously must have been confusing.
Yeah. And I also want to stress that, as we've discussed in the show before, like, observation and common sense do not always lead to scientific reality. You know, they can, these, you know, your gut instinct and just seeming, you know, observing how the world works, this can and has at times resulted in thoroughly non-scientific ideas. So I don't want to imply that in either group, it was just a matter of, oh, well, they just should have paid more attention and been more sensible.
Right. No, I didn't think you were saying that.
Okay. Just want to be clear.
But yeah, apparently Al-Hatib was mounting empirical arguments for contagion. But anyway, Stearns writes that, quote, far from having been accused of heresy for his statement on contagion, Ibn al-Hatib's opinions on the plague were debated by succeeding generations of scholars, as can be seen in a recently published collection of legal opinions from the 15th century, and in that his eventual trial for heresy was most likely politically motivated. You know, there was like a power struggle going on. And Stearns uses the example of this one figure to make the point that while some broad trends within religious communities can be observed, Stearns does agree that the majority view among Muslim jurists and theologians at the time is that plague is not contagious and is caused supernaturally by God, but just disagrees that Al-Hatib was the only person pushing back against this. Again, as he says, it was a minority view that was expressed and debated. And so the broader point I think he's making is that you can get a much more accurate picture of historical trends by understanding the diversity of thought within communities at the same time that you're trying to identify the broad or overriding trends that describe them. And from here, this is later in his conclusion that he cites this, but I found this really interesting. He quotes a completely inverse image of this comparative generalization about fatalism and belief in contagion in response to the plague. So he quotes a 21st century Tunisian scholar who makes use of an interesting anecdote from a 14th century figure named Ibn Marzuq al-Hafid. And al-Hafid writes that in this 14th century work that he was sent by the Sultan of Tlemcen, which is in modern-day Algeria, on a journey to the Sultan of Fez. And at that time, there was a great outbreak of disease in the stretch of North Africa known as the Maghreb. And as they traveled through the land, this figure was accompanied by a group of messengers, including one of whom was a Christian. And here I just want to read from Stearns' citation of this story, of this 14th century figure. Quote, "Their intention in doing what they did was not to approach the epidemic by entering the castle. This was their choice, and I was in agreement with them. The Christian asked, 'What's with these people who don't enter this place?' His translator, as he didn't speak Arabic well, said to him, 'They have fled from the epidemic.' Then the Christian said what we are told had the following meaning: 'Fleeing will not save them. There is no doubt that what God has decreed is what will be.' When I heard these words, I was dismayed and confused about what I was doing, as it was well known that according to prophetic tradition, one shouldn't approach such an area. I rejected completely that it should seem that one who had no knowledge of the Hadith, who is an unbeliever, should be greater in entrusting himself to God's order and more believing in what had been decreed. I knew that it was a trial, so I advised advancing and entered the castle, though I didn't order the others what to do." So this is interesting because Stearns notes that there's at least he cites a modern Tunisian scholar who has used this historical anecdote to argue the exact inverse, that Christians were fatalistic about the Black Death, and that though there were a diversity of views among Muslims, some argued for fleeing the plague and establishing quarantines on the basis of contagion theory. So I thought that was funny about how it can go both ways. And while there is, of course, a lot to be learned from comparative studies of religious interpretation in natural events, this kind of project can also just make it so tempting to make misleading generalizations on the basis of a single anecdote that you're aware of and sort of gloss over internal diversity and disagreement. Mm.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Stearns makes some other points in this paper that I think go to, apart from the contagion point, the other two characterizations that were made by Michael Doles. The first one was that plague was generally viewed as a mercy from God and a martyrdom for the faithful Muslim. And second, that a Muslim should not enter nor flee a plague-stricken land. And on these subjects, I thought this was interesting. And this goes along with something that I think comes through in several places in Stearns' argument, which is that he argues that there's often more similarity between the three different religions' responses than is appreciated, and that sometimes these theological debates about the plague are actually largely reproduced within each monotheistic religious community.
Mm-hmm.
So they share some similarities in their internal controversies and reactions. But he does argue, as Doles, I do think, acknowledge somewhat, that there were also views within the Muslim world that characterized the plague as a punishment for sin, as like the dominant view in Christian Europe was, and that in fact, in some cases, some Jewish sources from the time mentioned plague as being a punishment for sin as well. This just seems like this is a common place for the monotheistic religions to go mentally.
Yeah.
And as for some of these interesting internal controversies, Stearns talks about some conflict even between some of the ideas mentioned here, like, for example, he goes on to explain some of the origins of the prophetic tradition that one should neither enter nor leave an area where that is stricken by plague. And he says that these prophetic traditions, they gave rise to some difficulties in reconciling them with each other that had to be, and these differences had to be sorted out by later Muslim jurists and theologians. So, for example, one contradiction might be, on one hand, you have a belief that dying of plague can be a form of martyrdom, which is an honorable and good death, a mercy from God. And then on the other hand, you can have the belief that if plague is in an area, you shouldn't enter it. And so you could view these things as possibly being in contradiction with each other, but much like as we saw with the Christian tradition, I think Stearns idea here is that this just sort of gives rise to competing takes. Well, like with any other religion, you've got some authorities emphasizing one half of the tradition, some authorities emphasizing the other, some making mention, little mention of either one, and just sort of telling people to get away from the plague.
Mm.
Though this does make me think about a point of comparison that kept occurring to me, which was really funny, which is like just the trouble you get into if you just assume or try to infer religious beliefs and practices from the canonical traditions or scripture of a religion. It would be like trying to, do you think you could infer what Christians believe just by like looking at passages in the Bible?
Oh yeah. If you just draw one sometimes rather out of context. Yeah. You can, you could make all sorts of blanket statements. You know, in terms of thinking about illness as and disease as being a martyrdom, I'm reminded of something from later centuries in European tradition, the Eisenheim altarpiece by Matthias Grunewald. This would have been the early 16th century, but these are famous depictions in which we see Christ himself suffering from some sort of skin disease that I believe is thought to be ergotism. But in these cases, physical disease, physical ailment, it takes on the trappings of holy suffering.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. And actually, this is a thing that Stearns mentions. I skipped over it, but there is a part where he points out that actually thinking of death from plague as a form of martyrdom is not totally unique to Islam. There are also Christian traditions that characterize plague death as a martyrdom. They're not extremely common in Christianity, but he cites, for example, Cyprian, who apparently held this view that you could be a martyr after dying from plague. Or maybe not plague specifically, I'm not sure, but certainly from epidemic disease.
Right.
Another interesting point of similarity I was noticing is in reading about Stearns and then thinking about some of the stuff we talked about in the last episode was the idea of public demonstrations in response to plague, like public processions of various kinds. For example, Stearns writes that a common response to plague in Muslim cities throughout the Middle East was for people to go outside the city and fast and pray in groups. And this is, he says, similar to how Muslims might often appeal for deliverance from other disasters, non-disease disasters, like drought, they might gather outside the city to fast and pray for rain. But there's another thing I really take away from these discussions, which is something that Stearns emphasizes in this paper, which is that there's still a lot to learn and that is potentially available to learn. Not just like is definitely lost to history, because he says there are plenty of plague treatises from the time period, especially reflecting Jewish and Muslim views, that he says, quote, still languish in manuscript. So I think what that would mean is that there are cases where we have some kind of artifact, or original manuscripts do exist, but they are waiting for scholars to get to them, basically. We're waiting on them to be edited and translated. So there's still a lot more to learn about the period. And he suspects these will probably further tell against blanket generalizations of religious responses and might reveal more and more internal diversity of thought.
Yeah, because if it is true that basically within any of these faiths we're discussing, you had the same sort of arguments going on, the same sort of discussions, then that will just be further illuminated through the translations of these and the saving of these old texts.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to come back to before we wrap it up is that paper I quoted at the beginning of the episode, the paper by Nuket Varlik from the Journal of World History in 2013 called From Bête Noire to Le Mal de Constantinople, Plagues, Medicine, and the Early Modern Ottoman State. And so in this paper, she traces an interesting history. So she makes an argument that within the Ottoman Empire, so this would be the Muslim Empire based out of Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, that eventually spreads and controls much of the Middle East and North Africa and parts of Eastern Europe. She says that there is a transformation over time of how plague is conceptualized, and this happens especially in the 16th century. And this is something that's really important to consider, too. We've been talking about trying to appreciate the nuances within religious communities and the internal diversity, but also it's important to remember how views even of a single religious community change over time. So she says that before the 16th century, plague is seen mostly in religious terms, like we've been talking about, with, quote, with the general outlines of an Islamic plague cosmology, which had God and divine agency at its very core. And so under this view, like we've been saying, the most common belief is that epidemic diseases were sent directly from God, and only God had the power to alleviate your suffering. Though within the supernatural framework, of course, you could appeal to other supernatural interventions, such as the intercession of saints. And that makes me think about the story we started with the, you know, the saintly figure in green. And she writes in her conclusion, quote, in this configuration, disease was seen as an unfamiliar and unruly presence, a presence that the Ottomans imagined themselves as having no control over. Even in the medical works of the era, this supernatural vision was juxtaposed with the perplexing amalgamation of knowledge they had recourse to, which must have only confirmed perceived feelings of vulnerability. But then after this, she charts how during the 16th century, especially, there is a pretty rapid transformation of attitudes toward plague in the Ottoman Empire, including a shift from a majority supernatural view of disease to a much more natural and medical view of disease. So instead of being viewed as strange and unfamiliar threats over which we had no control, diseases came to be seen more as a, quote, familiar aspect of the natural realm, just one part of how the world works and something that we do have some kind of power to intervene against. And so this took the form of a new corpus of scientific knowledge about epidemic disease that was developed in the 16th century. And this would include discoveries about the causes, transmission, and prevention of infectious disease. And that this new knowledge led to changes in public health policy from the Ottoman state. It sort of took plague from being a predominantly supernatural issue and made it instead a political problem.
Well, that does seem the healthier trajectory for things to take, you know, to go from the supernatural to the idea that, yes, this is something that can be managed on some level.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think also, though, that, among all of these religious communities, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, all still today have religious approaches to disease, even if they would probably rely on science-based medicine as the primary intervention and way to prevent disease and heal yourself from disease if you do catch it. It's interesting that the introduction of science-based medicine as the primary effective way of combating disease has not removed the religious response to disease.
Right.
I mean, all of these communities still have religious thoughts about epidemics and still pray about them and all that. I guess another thing this whole discussion really drives home is how amazingly lucky we are in terms of the medical interventions that exist today. I mean, you know, everybody's exhausted living through a pandemic for the past however many god-awful months this thing has been. But I mean, we're so lucky to have the vaccines and the other interventions that we have today that were just not on the table for people in the 14th century.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, earlier I mentioned a Polish language anti-Semitic poster, and I just wanted to throw in a little more information on this because I kind of referred to it in passing. But this is a poster you can find at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's website at ushmm.org, where it's labeled anti-Semitic poster published in Poland in March 1941. Quote, an anti-Semitic poster published in Poland in March 1941. The caption reads, Jews are lice, they cause typhus. This German published poster was intended to instill fear of Jews among Christian Poles, unquote. So I just wanted to provide additional backstory on that particular poster I was referring to, and you can look it up if you visit this website. All right. Well, this has been a fun multi-part examination here, and I believe we're going to move on to other topics at this point, but we would love to hear from everyone out there if you have particular insight, if these episodes have touched on an area of expertise or interest and you would like to weigh in, then by all means, we'd love to hear from you. And it's not impossible that we could return to this topic if it looks like there are some interesting angles that need further exploration. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you will find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, which you will get wherever you happen to grab your podcasts. We have core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have listener mail on Mondays, Artifact on Wednesdays, and on Friday we do a little Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most of the science and just talk about a strange film. And on the weekends, we do a Vault episode.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.